From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. This week, we'll meet an American Pianist Award finalist who played a Haydn sonata right through a magnitude 6.1 earthquake. We'll hear why you should refuse a straw with your soft drink, and we'll meet a glassblower and a barbecue sauce master. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. On today's show, we'll learn how an obsession with a family recipe inspired a chef to become an Indiana artisan. But first, whether or not you're a fan, you've undoubtedly come across the Star Trek series or films at some point in life. Teleportation, communication devices, and phasers have been the products of this sci-fi dynasty for 50 years. But did you know that there are very real developments in this technology going on today? Contributor Pete Brown sat down with Mark Lasberry, an author, to learn more about his new book exploring Star Trek technologies in today's world.
Well, for decades, sci-fi writers have filled our imaginations with fantastic visions of alternate universes, alien beings, and inventions, I mean, all over the place, from hoverboards to lightsabers. Mark, your book, The Realization of Star Trek Technologies, the science, not fiction, behind brain implants, plasma shields, quantum computing, and more. Oh my gosh, this is like a dream come true for so many sci-fi fans. How on earth did you land at this spot to take a look at Star Trek technologies and start bringing these connections together between the real world and sci-fi fantasy from 50 years ago?
It was a crooked road. The writing that I was doing was mostly life sciences because that's where my training is. And an ex-colleague of mine had started a blog on the merging, the cross of pop culture and science because he also was trained in life sciences. The blog tended toward that. I decided that I wanted to try something that was a little more physical science. So I wrote a set of short pieces on these technologies from Star Trek, and they happened to be very well received. Then it turns out that 2016, the 50th anniversary of the franchise, and because it was so difficult to write short pieces on the technologies, it gave me the idea that perhaps there were, the science had matured enough that this could be expanded. And I contacted Springer International, and they were very enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, it seems to me like it's a long time coming, almost. I mean, geez, you meet so many people who are not just fans of certain genres and certain series of films and series of television programs, and they dissect it and they climb into it and they live it, and there's conventions about it. You know, I think the timing sounds fantastic. As I look through the table of contents, I see concepts like phaser weapons of less destruction, cloaking devices vanishing into thin space, the replicator, tractor beams, and so forth. It's fascinating. What bit of technology from Star Trek were you especially hot to learn more about or to apply some scientific concepts to?
Well, in the popular press, there had been quite a bit of interest in the idea of teletransportation. These things always, it intrigued me that they always end up with some sort of Star Trek name because that's what the media can compare them to so that the public has an idea of what they're getting into. And it's very sexy to talk about it in terms of the Star Trek. So I was interested in bringing some of those technologies that had matured to the point where we could begin to talk about them as being parallels to Star Trek technologies. And so teletransportation sort of got me into it. Then when I got into it, the one that really intrigued me the most was the Universal Translator.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Mostly because the technology for that has outstripped the conceptual knowledge by quite a bit. Things that we would need to make a universal translator, speech to text, text to speech, things like statistical machine translation, deep learning algorithms, those all exist.
Yeah.
It's a matter of knowing whether or not all languages have enough commonalities. They call them linguistic universals or linguistic tendencies. Does that exist to the point where you could make use of the technology that we have? So the knowledge of linguistics is actually behind the technology. And that was just about the only case that I ran into in the book.
Wow. Thinking back on your own personal history with Star Trek, is there a personal history? Are you? I know there's a constant debate with friends of mine who are into Star Trek, Trekkie versus Trekker. Now I've understood the term Trekkie is almost like a derogatory term, right? Trekker is if you mean business and you are a serious understander and you're a serious fan, you're a Trekker, and. Does that define you? Are you a Trekker from way back, or are you a scientist writing about pop culture?
Neither of those really applied. I had watched the original. I'm a child of the original series, and I watched it mostly for the action. I was 7, 8, 9 years old. The science itself was less intriguing, but coming back to it now. Writing the book really made me a much bigger fan than I was.
Interesting.
A lot of the research that I did brought into focus why certain things were done.
Yeah, interesting. So your background is in chemistry, pathology, molecular parasitology, and life science education. So you've been in this wheelhouse for a while in different capacities as far as understanding how to research and understanding how to draw these connections. Where did you go to research this? I mean, several of these things probably don't exist in a level that's easily accessible. You know, you couldn't just hop in the teleporter and go and write a little note to yourself about how it felt to go through it. I mean, where did you go for your research?
Being in the life sciences, the major advantage to that was that you learn how to assess scientific information. You learn how to read journal articles, pick out what you need, where to go to get the information.
During your research, were you watching the show to get ideas for chapters, or how did you get the ideas to break down the specific technologies that you wanted to feature?
Right. The technologies, first I started with the original series. Those that were there, then expanded upon that. But mostly it was looking for technologies that had matured to a point where we could draw parallels, but hadn't been passed by. Mm. I had no interest in writing about a communicator because the smartphone can do much more than what a communicator could. But in terms of things like replicators, you can make a... you can draw a parallel with molecular assembly, which is now starting to take off, nanotechnologies, building things at an atomic level so that they can be used to build other things at an atomic level. So it was there at the tipping point of where the research is now and what they're trying to actually get to, and then finding a good parallel for what is actually needed either now or in the near future.
Well, for folks that are interested in getting more information, getting their hands on a copy of the book, where should they go and what can they do? Amazon, obviously, they can go and search for The Realization of Star Trek Technologies and Mark Lasberry. Where else?
Well, Springer International, the publisher's website, is also a place that has the book and has featured the book. I also have a life sciences education blog called As Many Exceptions as Rules. That we've talked about the blog on, or talked about the book on that as well as this pop culture science blog that I started with Dr. Bill Sullivan called The Scope. So if you use The Scope or As Many Exceptions as Rules, those blogs have things written about the book.
Well, Mark, thanks very much. Live long and prosper.
Thank you much.
Author Mark Lasbury with contributor Pete Brown discussing Mark's new book, The Realization of Star Trek Technologies, from Springer Books. More information about the book and Mark can be found at springer.com. Sometimes being greener is so easy that you wonder why you didn't think of it sooner. Take drinking straws, for example. Nearly every restaurant automatically brings you a straw with your water or other cold beverage. Jim Poyser, executive director of Earth Charter Indiana, came up with an art project he's carried out with kids to help illustrate the waste. I asked Jim about the Straw Bale Project.
So I know you've done some research. How did we get to this place? Where did straws start?
I have not actually done that research, Sharon. I guess maybe the first straw was a hollow reed that was used in the cocktail emporium of the caves of the Neolithics. So, yes, of course, I did do the research on the Neolithics, and they were using the hollowed-out straw.
And there was a time when forgive me, I don't know when this was, but I do remember sometime in the late part of the last century thinking, why are they bringing kids straws for milk? Why are they bringing straws for water? And I assume there was some worry that glasses weren't clean enough and your lips weren't supposed to touch the glass. Is that?
Well, yes, and that actually is the one of the excuses that I've heard when it comes to local restaurants and people wanting straws and that sort of thing. But look, it really is, you got to start somewhere,
yeah,
in my estimation. Climate change and other environmental challenges are so vast that it can be very intimidating. So for me, to start small, refuse the straw,
bail on
is the way to do it. And it's also important to emphasize that this project, which was sponsored by the Da Vinci Pursuit here locally, is not about the banning of straws. It's about the voluntary commitment by local restaurants to simply not hand out a straw the minute you walk
right
in.
Right, and this project isn't very far down the road, and you've gotten some people to sign on already.
Sure, we just really got this started in the fall, and we have a half dozen restaurants signing on to that commitment. What was great was connecting with this school in Broad Ripple, the Village Montessori kids, and I'm a Montessori teacher by background, mm-hmm, so I love that system. And I encountered them because this was really a Broad Ripple Village Association project,
mm-hmm,
that I met with a bunch of restaurant owners one day in the late summer or whenever that was, and just said, look, here's what I'm doing. Will you collect straws for me?
Mm-hmm.
And so they did, and over the next couple of weeks, I went to about 10 Broad Ripple restaurants, collected about 10,000 straws,
oh,
hand washed them all because I didn't know who was going to be handling the straw bale, and assembled them together. I actually got a local artist, Nate Garvey, a Heron graduate, and he helped me sort of figure out the engineering of it.
Yeah, there's a pretty impressive, on your website, there's a really impressive structure because it sounds simpler than it really is.
Yes, it's not something I did actually a straw bale, the first one, and I used a lot of glue to attach the straws to each other.
Mm-hmm.
That just didn't seem very sustainable to me.
No.
So the second straw bale, with Nate's help, we actually created it with almost no glue whatsoever. And we used found objects to attach the straw mini bales together. And then, you know, the cordage that you lift the straw bale up, we actually used discarded plastic bags. Reverse twisted and tied together.
Sure.
So really the straw bale is in its entirety kind of a performance art, visual art piece about how wasteful we can be when it comes to straw. These bits of straw are finding their way into the landfill, I guess, if we're lucky, right? A lot of these straws are finding their way into the local environment, into the watershed, the soil shed. Plastic finds its way into the ocean all the time. We know there's massive islands of plastic in the ocean. And it's a polymer that breaks down into smaller and smaller bits. It never really goes away. And then we know that animals ingest it. Creatures ingest it. Not very good. I mean, when's the last time you had, you know, a nice piece of plastic for breakfast?
Jim Poyser is Executive Director of Earth Charter Indiana. You can learn about the Straw Bale, spelled B-A-L-E, project at thedavincipursuit.com. Again, thedavincipursuit.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, we'll meet another of the American Pianists Awards finalists. But first, Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger spoke with Fawn Smits of Tulip Tree Creamery about their new National Good Food Award and more.
Tulip Tree, we are in production about 2.5 years right now. So officially, we were founded December 2013, but we made our first cheese and we sold our first cheese in June of 2014. And so that's, yeah, it's been 2.5 years and it's been going great.
Well, now tell me a little bit about your background. You've been part of the Indianapolis local food scene for a long time, right?
Yes, I think for Indianapolis right now since 2003, I've been in here in Indiana. But yeah, it's been, I've been in the dairy itself, I've been for over 25 years. Yeah, my background is I graduated in Holland at a dairy institute for in dairy food technology, specialized in dairy science.
Did you know you wanted to do that? Was it something you always wanted to do?
It fascinated me. That was the key thing. And I think part of it, because I grew up in this tiny little village, you know, we had about 2,000 people there living in a village called Koudum in the southwest corner of the province of Friesland in the northern part of the Netherlands. Everything was surrounded by dairy fields, you know, it's a pasture and lots of dairy farms. A lot of my friends had, you know, were growing up on dairy farms, so I spent a lot out there.
Now tell me a little bit more about the Trillium and the Good Food Award.
Yeah, so the Trillium is a triple cream Bloomy Rind cheese. It's a nice cheese, it's a nice mild, usually a lot of people like it because it's not so pungent, it's not strong flavored, but it's so nice and creamy and soft. As it ripens, it gets very nice. You know, it kind of melts on your tongue feeling, and that's how it tastes too. It's great on like on a burger. Eat it like that. Eat it like a slice. It just it goes with everything. It's perfect on a cheese plate. And so that's what we entered in our Good Food Awards for this year in January was the official awards. And that is a national award where they, you know, a lot of creameries throughout the nation can send the products, and they kind of split up the nation in certain regions. So that's really great. And they do a blind tasting on all those products, and that's the first round. You have to get through that. So that's really about the quality of the product. After that, they do another test and see if you're how you actually are producing the products. They actually look at the source of your ingredients. What does the company stand for? You know, how do you handle materials? That's why we recycle the whey. We started with a farmer here who is picking up the whey now from us. We switched over some of our packing materials to be much more environmental friendly. So it's a lot about those kind of things, what you stand for as a company. You know, our farm right now, we go through the humane certification, and that's very much about how are the animals being treated. It's a very big thing. Those are the key things with that kind of award.
Where does the milk come from? Where is the farm, and is it local? I think people wonder about that sort of thing.
Yeah, we buy milk. All our milk is coming from a family farm in Seymour, Indiana, and so it's great. The farm has been there for many, many years. Yeah, the farmer brings up the milk 3 times per week, and it's great. Like today, he was milking in the morning, and then he brings it all to us, and it's great. So it's 3 times per week he brings the fresh milk in. Yeah, and he actually, the nice thing about he does too is that we pack product for him, and he sells it on the farmers markets around Seymour. So it's and then we actually put his name on the label as well, and that's a very big thing. So we're as a creamery, we're not only looking for hey, we just need a source of milk. We're looking very much at you know who is the farmer, how is he farming, you know how is he managing, what kind of family, how is he treating the animals, and that kind of stuff inspires us about okay, what kind of products, what kind of great products can we make out of that. And that makes it too. It's like our sales manager makes it her excited about sell that product, you know.
Now people can try your products at the farmers markets when they see them. It seems like you're always sampling and there's always people there. But people can also take classes and learn how to make it at home, or at least learn how you make it here. So tell me a little bit about the classes that you have at Tulip Tree.
Yeah, one of the big things which we really wanted to do with the company is about educating the people too about how these products are being made, and do that in a very informal way. So we have a nice class setting where we have two types of classes right now. We do a fresh cheese making class where we teach people how to make mozzarella and queso blanco. And then we have an aged cheese class where we teach people how to make the gouda. It's very hands-on. We really want people to learn how to do this. Makes it a little bit easier for them if they want to try it at home. Give them little tips about it so they learn everything about the cheese making process. Part of the class is also eating a lot of cheese. So we have all our cheeses up here for people to taste. And then at the end of the class, they get to take the cheese home.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. Stephen Lin is one of the American Pianist Classical Fellowship finalists, and WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer has been having conversations with each of the finalists as they prepare to play in the Discovery Series this month and in the finals in April.
Sharon, like all the other finalists, Stephen has won many competitions, and he also plays with this kind of a chamber music boy band in Korea, which is a lot of fun for him. He was actually born here in the United States, but his family lives in Japan. So he visits there, he plays there, he also teaches there quite a bit. So I started our conversation by asking him if he makes time or if he even has time to actually get to know a city when he visits it, including Indianapolis.
For me, I think in the end, it's like the people that you meet that are, you know, the connections, the relationships that you built throughout your travels. That's what makes this, you know, what I do extra special, I think. Yeah.
And because you do travel so much and perform in so many different venues, is there one style of venue or type of venue that you prefer to perform in?
Yes. I think ideally for me, obviously, it's different for solo and when you play with orchestra. But for solo stuff, I think ideally for me, kind of 400 to 500 seats, this type of more intimate halls are very important because, it can capture kind of the intimacy of the music that maybe a bigger hall cannot capture. But I think ideally for a concerto concert, I really like these 1,200-seat halls. For me, the intimacy part of the music is very important. And sometimes obviously it depends on the hall. I played in Carnegie Stern back in March, and that felt amazing. It didn't feel like the hall sat about 2,000 people. But when you're there, it feels smaller. It feels, you know, you're with the audience. I think the important part is maybe that, you know, I need to feel that I'm able to communicate with the audience. Maybe it's not so much about the number of seats. The combination of this atmosphere of the hall and the audience, you can feel it really makes a difference in the music making. You can feel that the focus, the concentration of the audience is there, like they're really listening sensitively. And as a performer, you know, yes, it could be scary, but you also really appreciate because you feel like they're really listening to the nuance of the music and to your take, to the expression, to the interpretation of what you're doing.
Stephen says he hated to practice when he was a kid, but now he knows that practice and digging deeper into himself will only make him a better musician.
And it's a combination of course, the composer's music, the music that they wrote, and, of course, piano, the instrument, whatever you're playing, and yourself, kind of this combination of everything. And you can play a Beethoven sonata or a Chopin mazurka for your entire life, and you can still discover something. There's just something beautiful about practicing that same phrase, going to that same phrase each day that you wake up, and discovering that there's always something new. I think that's the beauty of classical music.
Now, I understand you're a big Lakers fan too, right?
Yeah. I was born in L.A.
If you could put together music to play for a Lakers game, classical music, what would it be? Who would it be? What would it be? What would?
I would think it would be like Liszt, you know, because Liszt was a kind of a rock star of his time. Or like Horowitz transcriptions of, you know, Carmen, I don't know, those really virtuosic type of music. I think it really would fit that kind of setting.
You know, I always love to talk with these finalists about the other things that they do in life, and they actually do other things besides play the piano. And most of them teach and spend time with kids. And Stephen especially, this is something that he is one of his passions, is working with kids and getting to know them. And then they kind of stay in touch via social media and such after he leaves the city. And part of the APA finals, a big part of it, is when the finalists come to town, they spend time working in a local high school with the students as well. So it's a good way for them to hone that skill and to also create an environment of a love for classical music for the next generation, which is very important. And you're going to be able to hear Stephen's performance from the Discovery Series this Sunday night on 90.1, starts at 7 o'clock.
Fantastic. And you know, the great thing about working with kids as a musician is if you can speak with kids about music, you can speak with any audience about music. So that sort of ensures that the love will be spread throughout the world.
I think we have some other things going on too this week, Sharon.
Speaking of spreading the love of the arts, I think we have some things going on our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
Well, this is a little ways away, but it's a big enough deal that I wanted to bring it to your attention now so you can maybe make some plans. The John Hartford Memorial Festival is coming up yet again. It's at Bill Monroe's Bean Blossom, and it's May 31st through June 3rd. If you don't know who Johnny Hartford was, just go to YouTube and search John Hartford, and you will get an idea about his high-spirited love of bluegrass music and just absolutely irresistible rhythm and way crazy lyrics and so on and so forth. And, of course, there's tons of other performers at the festival as well. Again, that's coming up in Bean Blossom, May 31st through June 3rd, the John Hartford Memorial Festival.
Big weekend coming up ahead at the Jazz Kitchen. With a couple of musicians that have a really kind of close ties to us here at NPR and PBS in general. On March the 17th, respected jazz musician Gary Burton, he's retiring this year, and he's actually making his last U.S. stop, the Jazz Kitchen, that Whoa. Night on March the 17th. He's giving two performances that night at 7 and 9:30 p.m. He's going to be featured on Jazz Night in America, too, the NPR show as well. That's a great night to see. And then the next night, on March the 18th, Brandon Meeks is going to be performing two shows, once again at 7 and 9:30. And Brandon has been one of our featured artists here on Art of the Matter, and he has been part of our small studio sessions with Native Son, and a great local musician. So two great nights of jazz, the 17th and 18th, at the Jazz Kitchen up there in Broad Ripple.
And we're all over the map, from bluegrass to jazz to classical music. The Hendrix Symphony Orchestra and Chorus is presenting a concert this Sunday afternoon at 3 at Avon Middle School. It's called The Brassy Chorus, and it's excerpts from opera, both vocal and choral, as well as instrumental excerpts from operas as well. You can find out more about that by just going to a search engine and typing in Hendrix Symphony Orchestra.
Beauty and the Beast is coming to the IMAX Theater downtown Indianapolis. This is a great place to see a film. And they're also offering a Disney-themed costume and tea party on their opening weekend. It's Saturday, March the 18th at 10 a.m. in the morning is the tea party, followed by the screening of the movie. But then the movie is going to be available there to see for weeks after that. And if you've never seen a movie at the IMAX, it's a great place to see one, and it's a beautiful venue to see what a film that you would see in a normal theater. I saw La La Land there, and it adds a whole new experience with the sound and the color and everything. So check out the IMAX Theater downtown for Beauty and the Beast.
Hey, Robert Schenken is a name you might not, it might not ring bells with you right away, but if you are the sort of person who looks carefully in a program book at the theater or watches film credits, you might say, oh yeah, that's that guy. The New Harmony Project is presenting an evening with Robert Schenken on Friday, March 17th at the IRT in the Cabaret Room. Robert Schenken is a Pulitzer Prize winner, he's a Tony Award winner, he's a Writers Guild Award winner, Emmy and Academy Award nominated writer of stage, television, and film. That does not all fit on a business card, but he's a fascinating guy with a lot of amazing insights into how you make creative work for stage and screen. So go to New Harmony Project online to find out more about an evening with Robert Schenken, Friday the 17th. Do it soon.
Wednesday, March 22nd at 7 p.m., the Hope College Chapel Choir is coming to the Pilgrim Lutheran Church in Carmel. They have been featured on PBS during a couple of those Christmas Vesper programs that many of you have watched on TV, and they will be there performing at 7 o'clock at the Pilgrim Lutheran Church in Carmel.
Well, you know what? We have lots and lots of more things to tell you about, but we're out of time. Don't forget, you can always find out more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or tune in again next week for our calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, and I'm Sharon Gamble. WFYI's Jill Sheridan took her young daughter and son to the Children's Museum to check out their newest exhibit called Circus Starring You. The interactive experience gives young children the opportunity to enjoy the sights, sounds, and feelings of being in the circus.
Driving up to the Children's Museum in Indianapolis is always an exciting experience for any child and adult.
Did you see that circus thing?
Yeah.
We're here to check out the museum's newest exhibit, Circus Starring You. I asked Veronica about a book we often read called Part-Time Princess and what the princess studies.
What did she do?
Circus arts.
The smell of popcorn in the air and the sounds of the big top. Max and Veronica can't wait. When you walk inside, the interactive exhibit unfolds. Children can swing from rings, juggle, ride a unicycle, drive a clown car, and dress up as an array of circus performers. A small room off the side of the exhibit is reserved for families to practice their routine and bring it out into one of the rings to perform. Exhibit's manager, Monica Humphrey, says crafting the Circus Starring You just made sense.
And having roots in Indiana, up in Peru and in Miami County, it was a no-brainer for us to bring this story to life. So we talk about a variety of different circuses throughout history and throughout the world, and really focus that story on circus arts and performance and the people who bring it to life.
The art of the circus runs through generations, says Humphrey.
The family element is so huge, whether your biological family or you have joined the circus and then they become your family. It's a really strong message that we're trying to communicate to.
The museum enlisted Montana Miller as a consultant to help them with the exhibit. Miller is a former aerialist and a circus arts expert.
So, for example, I suggested that they have a human cannonball and that they shoot a kid out of it and make that like a show. And I really did not think that they would actually do it. And the next time I came to work with them, they had the prototype and they were testing it and they were all like, so excited about it.
I ask her what's the draw of the circus arts for children and families.
For the audience, it's all about watching somebody take a risk, right? And for kids and parents, there's that whole relationship of tension where the kids always want to take risks and explore, and the parents are worried about their safety. So here we have an environment where kids get to sort of try in a safe environment the idea of, you know, what if I wanted to be a circus performer?
A classic art, of course, is the ability to walk a tightrope. A virtual reality experience lets kids experience what it really feels like. A few kids turn back. It's too scary. But not for Veronica. The crowd cheers. And after seeing his sister do it, Max completes the death-defying feat as well. On opening day, a special performance featured Montana in an aerial ring performance in the museum's main floor.
So to go back and do an act that I used to do in my 20s, now that I'm in my 40s, I have been training my butt off for 2 or 3 months now, and I'm exhausted. And it's been quite a challenge, but really rewarding.
On our way out, we catch the act. Circus Starring You runs through November at the Children's Museum.
WFYI's Jill Sheridan and her children, Veronica and Max, visited the Children's Museum's new Circus Starring You experience. You can get yourself shot out of a cannon or try the Roman ladder at the museum through November. Technology is more sophisticated than ever, yet we live in an era of craft. Craft beer, craft cocktails, artisanal meals and jewelry and furniture. Indiana Artisan is a statewide juried network of craftspeople who work in culinary, beverage, and fine arts arenas. And on March 25th and 26th, Indiana Artisan is offering its 7th annual marketplace. If you show up at the exposition hall at the Indiana State Fairgrounds, you'll get to meet artists like my next guest, glass artist Lisa Pillow, barbecue sauce master Lafay Pagiz, and Indiana Artisan Executive Director Eric Freeman. Eric, I'm going to start with you. Remind us of the mission and vision. What is Indiana Artisan?
Well, Indiana Artisan was started in 2008, so this is our 10th year. And
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The goal is to identify and recognize Indiana's highest quality artisans and to help them expand their businesses through increased sales, which is what the marketplace does.
And what is an artisan?
An artisan can be a food artisan or an art artisan. The house has two sides to it, and it's very broad. And sure and truly, it can be just about anything. Jewelry makers, glass blowers, woodworkers, paper artisans. On the art side, and then on the food side, you know, sauces, syrups, candies, cookies, noodles. We define art and food very broadly.
But there's a, if I recall, there is a kind of a an upper limit to the production before you become, you're an artisan until you're not, then you're a mass producer, right?
That's true.
And all of the current artisans are not mass producing their
wares. Right. And that's an important part that kind of helps be a reason to come to the marketplace. I mean, all of these folks make their own work. And all of these folks are at the marketplace. So it's an opportunity to meet the people who make what you see in their booths.
All right. So, and we have two of the makers here. Lisa, tell me about your craft. How did you get started? How did you decide if you're like, okay, I'm a visual artist, but what do I want to, what feels right in my hands?
Well, I'll say I've always been an artist. However, when I went to Bowling Green State University in Ohio, I started there in creative writing, and I was mostly through my way making in my degree pursuing writing, and just needed to get some elective hours, and so they offered glass blowing, and I said, well, that looks pretty neat. Ohio's really big in glass studios and glass blowing, and I took it as an elective and said, I need to stay and get a degree in it. And so I do have a BFA specializing in glass.
That's a big change.
I feel it's an extension of creativity because writing is creative.
Right.
And it was a new pursuit. Obviously, I'd never worked with hot glass, but I've always painted and worked with leather and clay and all of that. It was really big in my school system. Mm-hmm. And so that step to glass was just intriguing. I couldn't pass it up. And
let me ask you this in the bridging the gap or crossing the boundaries between writing and glass, making glass objects. Writing, no matter what your outlet, is largely about storytelling, whether you're a nonfiction writer or a poet or a novelist. Are you telling a story when you're making work in glass?
Absolutely. That's an excellent correlation. There is a never-ending story to working with hot glass. It is always a forward pursuit, learning a new technique, a new color application, a new form. And the creative aspect of that is endless. In fact, it's the expanse of glass blowing and glass art is so expansive that just in writing, you've got to narrow your focus. And certainly the path I've chosen in blowing glass is I've really narrowed it down, very different from other glass artist pursuits. And taking the direction I've gone, working mostly independent most of my glass blowing career, my goal to develop my own studio, have my own studio, you really have to focus in, and I feel that's probably with all the rest of the artists, too. They just got to have tunnel vision.
And, you know, you might still have another chapter. You might suddenly switch to some other art form.
That's absolutely true. I feel, though, in glass right now, I am more intrigued with solid form sculpture. I've been dabbling in that a little bit, so it's not necessarily blowing, but I still do large-scale blown work, plus all the work that you'll see at the Artisan Marketplace this season in March. But I am kind of intrigued by the notion of sculpting with larger scales, sculpting in larger scale. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, that's my little dabble outside of my norm.
So speaking of meandering careers, Lethe, you were trained as a broadcast journalist.
Yes.
Where did sauce making come in?
Well, sauce making has been in my blood since before I knew I wanted to be a broadcaster.
Really?
My grandpa, the name of my sauce is John Toms, and that's my grandpa. His name was John Tom Branson. And all my life, that's what I knew him for is mm-hmm. barbecue. And he had a secret sauce that he made. And so growing up, you have soccer families and you have football families. We were a barbecue family. He barbecued a lot and sold dinners from his house. And he had this sauce. And he passed away when I was 11 years old. And he took that with him because he never wrote his recipe down.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So
you're in pursuit of recreating that flavor.
I tried to recreate his sauce for years. I didn't get it. So I just started all over from scratch and created my own. When I decided to start a business with it, it was an honor to put his name on that because that's what he did and wanted to do. So it's kind of like I'm just carrying out his dream. I kind of continued it.
Are there other sauce makers in your family? Do you have siblings or cousins or anybody
Here's the interesting thing. My grandpa and his brothers all made barbecue sauce, and they would always compare or say who's the best and get their kids on it, who's taste the best. But I'm the only one from my generation that, took it a little further. So
that's fantastic. Yeah. And you got to get somebody in the next generation after you interested.
Well, every chance I get, I have three kids and I try to get them in the kitchen and teach them things because I want somebody to take over when I'm done, you know. So
it's one thing to make to cook something for yourself and to if you cook the way I cook, it's like a pinch of this and a little bit of that and a splash more of this. But you have to be way more intentional and somewhat more scientific about it so you can recreate it, right?
Yes. Well, that's how my grandpa made his sauce. Like I said, he never wrote anything down. It was just pour here, pinch of it, and it turned out the same every time. I don't know how, but when I start going through the process, I got my notepad and batch number one. I wrote down the recipe and however it come out, if I needed to tweak it, then I'd go to batch number two. And so, so you have to take notes and keep precise measurements when you're trying to produce something for the public.
Indiana Artisan Executive Director Eric Freeman, Barbecue Sauce Master Lafay Pegues, and Glass Artist Lisa Palo. In the Exposition Hall at the Indiana State Fairgrounds on Saturday and Sunday, March 25th and 26th, you can meet Lafay, Lisa, and more than 130 of their fellow artisans, creating everything from marshmallows to metalwork and pottery to photography. 24 of the artisans will demonstrate their craft, and you can learn lots more and get tickets at indianaartisan.org. You can see Lisa's work at hotblownglass.com and imagine Lafay's spicy barbecue flavors at johntomsbbq.com. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto, and today on Art of the Matter, I'm going to be sharing five of my favorite songs celebrating the Indian Festival of Colors known as Holi. This year, Holi will begin on Sunday, March 12th, but Holi festivities will continue throughout the spring. And in Indianapolis, you can celebrate Holi on Saturday, April 15th at the India Association of Indianapolis's annual Holi event. This year's Holi celebration is from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on the west side at the Mega Mall on Pike Plaza Road. Check out the India Association of Indianapolis's Facebook page for more info. Holi is a fantastic celebration that involves throwing colored powder and colored water at your friends. Music is a big part of the celebration, and we're going to hear five of my favorite Holi songs from Bollywood films. Up first, we have a classic from one of the most iconic Indian films ever made, Mehboob Khan's 1957 masterpiece, Mother India. This is Holi Aire Kanai, composed by the great Naushad and voiced by Shamshad Begum. Our second Holi selection is from another heavyweight Bollywood classic, the 1975 action-adventure film Sholay. This is Holi Ke Din, written by my favorite Bollywood composer R.D. Burman and sung by Lata Mangeshkar and Kishore Kumar. And for our third song, I want to play another R.D. Burman composition, again featuring Lata Mangeshkar and Kishore Kumar on vocals, from the 1970 film Kati Patang. This is Ajana Chodenge.
आज न छोड़ेंगे आज न छोड़ेंगे बस हम झोली खेलेंगे हम होली खेलेंगे हम होली.
For my fourth holy pick, I want to play a more contemporary tune. From 2013, this is Balama Pichikare from the film Ye Jawani, Hey Diwani, as composed by Pritam.
Balam pichikari jo tune mujhe mari to bole re zamana kharab ho gayi mere ang raja jo tera rang laga to seedhi saadhi chori sharab ho gayi.
And our fifth and last pick is one of the great anthems of Holi. From 1981, this is the great superstar actor Amitabh Bachchan with Ranga Barse.
Oh! Ranga Barse, are Ranga Barse, big chunar wali Ranga Barse.
Ranga Barse.
I'm Kaya Long from Cultural Manifesto, and we just heard five of my favorite Bollywood songs celebrating the Indian festival of colors known as Holi.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Pete Brown, Jill Dittmeyer, and Jill Sheridan. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 9 after Indivisible. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, we'll meet a visual artist who lives and creates with Parkinson's disease and discover why John Jacob Audubon could easily be a contemporary self-made man. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.